From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when one of the most highly rated restaurants in the world announced a major change. This week, the chef of 11 Madison Park in New York City announced that when the renowned restaurant opens again for indoor dining later this spring, there will be no meat on the menu. In fact, Chef Daniel Hum says there will be no animal products at all on the menu. They will use plant-based butters. They will remove fish from the menu. They will no longer offer the many dishes that made the restaurant famous in the first place. The Washington Post writes that on his restaurant's website, Hum said that the past year, when his acclaimed restaurant closed and he and his team focused on feeding the hungry through a partnership with a nonprofit group, had changed his perspective. Hum said, quote, "We have always operated with sensitivity to the impact we have on our surroundings, but it was becoming ever clearer that the current food system is simply not sustainable in so many ways," end quote. Now, there's no way to tell if the move made by 11 Madison Park will spark a change in other restaurants. After all, the tasting menu at 11 Madison Park is $335. But even fast food restaurants like Burger King have been offering meatless burgers. Grocery stores carry more options. Things have been changing. All of which brings us to a debate that I found fascinating. This week, New York Times columnist Ezra Klein had a lot to say about this. He has been vegan for years. Klein wrote, quote, "There is no doubt that being vegan and vegetarian is less delicious. People who argue otherwise are kidding themselves. But a lot of that is because there are fewer options on menus, so much less money driving creativity. The more plant-based eaters and chefs there are, the tastier it'll get," end quote. Now, that set off a wave of complaints from readers who argue that meat does not inherently mean more delicious. Last night, Klein sought to clarify his remarks. He wrote, quote, "Some people read me as saying any vegetarian food is intrinsically less delicious than any food with meat. That's silly, but that's not what I wrote. I wrote that being a vegetarian or a vegan comes at a cost in the everyday deliciousness of what you eat. And it does. This is important to admit because it's a key reason why most people don't sustain becoming vegetarian or vegan for very long. Lots of people try it, but they fall out because the world is built to make it hard. You're routinely confined to one or two items on a restaurant menu, and they're often bad. You go to a dinner party, and you can eat some side dishes. And that's to say nothing of your options in airports, at buffets, etc." End quote. Klein hopes that the recent high-profile changes in the food world will force all chefs and food purveyors to treat meatless options as more than a throw-in or an afterthought or a veto item. And to be honest, I kind of thought we were already close to there, but maybe I'm wrong here. In this hour, we explore the changes that have been happening as chefs try to make truly inspiring, delicious food, meat or no meat, fish or no fish, animal products or not. Our guests include the owner of the Playhouse Swillburger and a pizza wizard himself, Brian Van Etten, is with us. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Chris Lindstrom is the founder of Curate. He's also the founder and host of the great podcast we've loved for years, Food About Town, and someone who's made some big changes in his own eating habits. Hi, Chris.
How you doing today? Doing fantastic over here.
Well, it's great. Doing just great. And I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Brian, you are the owner of the Playhouse and Swillburger. I'm less familiar, I'm embarrassed to say, with Pizza Wizard. Can you give us a quick rundown here?
Sure. Pizza Wizard is a pizza spot we had been working on for a handful of years, and construction began, then COVID hit. Construction slowed down. We kept plugging, and we opened up in late October of last year. So we've been open about 6 months right now. We just serve, you know, we just want to be a pizzeria. Nothing too fancy, nothing too different, except our claim to fame right now is that we do a pretty solid rendition of a Detroit-style pizza, which is a nice, thicker, fluffier dough. So that's what we're doing over there.
All right. So you're doing pizza there. You're doing burgers, not exclusively, but a lot of burgers at Playhouse and Swillburger. And you're someone in this restaurant world, in our own little ecosystem here. You've done a lot. I mean, that's what you're involved with right now, but you've been involved in other restaurants locally. Can you just mention a little bit of the resume? Because I think it's pertinent to what we're talking about here.
Yeah, my locally, my other kind of main point on my resume would be was one of the people that helped get off the ground the Owl House. When the Owl House opened, you know, I think it's been over a decade. I can't remember exactly how long, but you know, we sort of, not, I wouldn't say started the trend of offering vegetarian items, because there had been many vegetarian and vegan restaurants, at least a few before us, but we kind of did our best to have equally delicious and equally as many offerings in for vegetarians and vegans, as well as omnivores. And the Owl House is still going strong on that principle. So there we have it.
Yeah, and so let me ask both of you, just for a brief take on 11 Madison. I think Chris's own food story is going to be really pertinent here. But Brian, when you heard that 11 Madison, which is, you know, sort of at the pinnacle of Manhattan dining, they didn't announce that they're going to have a goal of serving less meat, or they're going to phase it out slowly, or they're going to double the amount of vegan options. I mean, it's all changing next month. That did shock a lot of the people that I sort of follow. What did you think?
I think it's one of the most amazing things I've heard in the food industry in a long time. I love that decision so much, and I find it difficult to find something not to like about what they're doing at 11 Madison. You know, there's plenty of very high quality, even very high end vegetarian and vegan restaurants in New York City, especially, or at least a good amount. But when you have somebody with such a profile as Daniel Hum and his business partner over there, and their restaurant, 11 Madison Park, making that change, you know, it's hard for other restaurateurs not to take notice. I may not be doing fine dining, and taking a fine dining menu 100% vegan in the Rochester area may not be sustainable at this point, at least. But it's honestly opened the door for someone like myself to really kind of reevaluate, you know, are there benefits to what they're doing out there that we could take to our market, to our restaurants, that would prove beneficial in many ways. So that news just opened this door. And like I said, there's been a handful of incredible vegetarian and vegan restaurants in Rochester already. And sadly, it took me reading and learning about someone who had such a prominent restaurant making this radical change to kind of open up that door in my own mind. Is that something, you know, are there principles in that change that would be worthwhile for me to think about in the businesses I currently operate? So I love the decision. I think it's got a lot of potential benefits. I don't think that, you know, 11 Madison Park going vegan is going to save the environment or change a million minds. But for me, as an operator and someone who's typically focused in kitchens, it's inspiring. It's super inspiring. You know, it may seem like a limitation to some, but sometimes when you limit yourself, you really figure out how creative you can be and different techniques and ingredients you can use to get results that are just as good, and if not better, than some animal products.
That's so interesting. And that's what I want to focus on as we really kind of really get into it this hour, is the notion of what it means as a chef and a restaurant to really focus on making something great, as opposed to like, yeah, we can have like a vegetarian pasta. You know, I mean, like, and so I really kind of want to dig into that with you. But the one other thing I wanted to ask you, Brian, is here's what I don't know how to evaluate with the whole 11 Madison Park thing. So I assume prices will stay the same or roughly the same. It's $335 to go eat there and to get the tasting menu, which is what people do when they go there. Let's assume it's still that. I mean, it's very exclusive. It's very out of reach for a lot of people. And immediately when they came out with this decision, I heard prognostication that, well, this will be good for a month and then their business will collapse. And people won't want to go out and not be able to get meat. People don't want to spend that much money and not be able to get meat. On the other hand, there's this prognostication that this will become a curiosity and people will flock to this because they'll want to see how good you can do it at the highest level with no animal products at all. And that will sustain it for a while. But in that way, it would be kind of a unicorn. And it's going to be hard for me to tell. I mean, unless business collapse entirely or, you know, all of a sudden they can't fill the restaurant, then we'll certainly see that there was kind of a backlash, Brian. But even if they fill the restaurant, it's such a unicorn that I don't know if it means that everybody could do it, if that makes sense. I don't know. How to view this?
That makes complete sense. And to be clear, this will not be the first time something like this has been done. You know, there's a chef in Chicago, Grant Achatz, who owns and operates a restaurant that's called Next. And next is, you know, Grant Achatz is one of, you know, he's right up there, if not considered better than Daniel Hum and some of the other top chefs in the world. And what next was, and I don't know, I believe they still are, is it's a rotating restaurant that basically for a month or 2 months or 3 months, I'm not positive, they have a different concept. And for a handful of months, I believe it was 2014, 2015, sometime around then, one of the best chefs in the world put out a 35-course tasting menu that was all vegan. And as with any of the other pop-up type restaurants, they did it in, as this next concept. You couldn't get in. You could not get in. And it was hugely successful. And actually, you know, the reviews I read at the time were just incredible. So to your question, will this be a unicorn? You know, it truly is all about the clientele at this point. It depends if the market is there, you know.
And people demand it, yeah.
And the demand, that's the scariest part, you know. There was a moment last night after we spoke on the phone briefly where I was so inspired. I'm like, yes. You know, I want Swillburger to be a vegan restaurant, and that'll drive creativity to do more things and cooler things and more interesting things. But what if it fails?
Yeah, you know, or you'll be out of business, right?
Yeah, or you'll be out of business. So I guess that time will tell.
Yeah, and I already have some emails coming in. Listeners, I want to make sure I'm clear about something. I'm not suggesting that 11 Madison Park is becoming the first vegan restaurant. What I'm suggesting is it's the highest profile restaurant that has an established reputation, a well-known menu, critical reviews, and it is entirely doing a facelift and going vegan from an established base point. So, you know, to me, this is even different than if Thomas Keller or somebody else wanted to open a fully vegan restaurant. This is an in the middle of its existence established restaurant making this switch. I'm sure it's happened, to Brian's point. And, you know, I read about a place in Paris that did the same. But it's going to be fascinating to see if this is a one-off. Chris Lindstrom, what did you think when you heard this news from 11 Madison Park?
Yeah, I kind of agree with Brian. I mean, it's definitely inspiring, and it is a big shift to your point, but kind of what this pandemic has allowed in a lot of ways, you know, they had to slow down. They switched to takeout only. It's offered a lot of opportunities to reevaluate priorities. And many of the articles, they referenced different priorities that, you know, with maybe with the lower food costs, higher labor costs, but that balance, they're going to be able to provide more food to people by doing that and reevaluating the priorities at a $335 tasting menu cost. And what are they really doing with their platform? And I think that's, you know, just as valuable, if not anything else, that it forces a lot of these conversations to happen. And not in a pedantic way either, like in a real world way where every meal they sell, I think they said they were going to provide 5 meals to people at no cost, you know, for part of their nonprofit work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's an important part of the conversation. It's cool. I mean, I'm excited to try to go there when I get a chance. But yeah, this is certainly not the first. And, you know, chefs like Dominique Crenn out on the West Coast switched to no meat, I think 2 years ago. I think she still serves seafood, but, you know, reducing is certainly on trend all over the country. And, you know, we have a solid base of things here as well.
When did you make a switch personally, Chris?
So about a year and a half ago, I switched to about 90% vegan. And then about a year ago, I've been basically as close to 100% as I can.
What is the last piece of meat you ate?
Whole piece? Oh, geez.
No. Okay, whole piece or partial?
Piece of meat since, yeah, I've had a bite or two here and there of my wife's food just so I can evaluate like what a restaurant's doing at the time. But I haven't had a full piece of meat since probably September of 2019.
Do you miss
it? It's been a long time.
Do you miss it?
Up and down. I've had moments. I was on the road a lot last year for work. And I went into a coffee shop for breakfast one day, and they were batch cooking bacon for the day. And I had this visceral, like, I was shaking. This was like, oh my God, this smells amazing. I got over that pretty quick. But you know, it doesn't happen very much. And to be honest, over the last, you know, six to nine months, it doesn't really come up much anymore. I don't really think about it. and, you know, the bites I've had haven't been inspiring or wanted me to go back to it at all.
Okay, so when you dine, and obviously we're talking the last year for you, essentially fully vegan, which perfectly corresponds with the pandemic, which makes every question I'm about to ask a little bit limited here. But when you dine, whether it's takeout or going out, or even just sort of doing research for the work that you do, what are you finding when it comes to the options you as a diner have? That's part of what Ezra Klein is arguing when he said it's a more delicious life to be a meat eater. He's not saying it's inherently always tastier. It's just harder to find. It's still harder to find what he would want or need, or at least the attention and the quality to it. What are you finding?
So to respond to his statement, I'm not sure I could disagree more. I think he has a very limited view on what food is, if that's the case for him. It's not to say that it's not more work sometimes. I'm not going to deny that. And, I have the privilege to buy, local produce and, buy interesting ingredients and things like that. And I do spend time prepping food. I seriously and completely disagree with this statement that it's less delicious to eat vegan. It's a matter of attention to detail. It's easier to eat meat and have it be delicious. I mean, you can buy a piece of grass-fed, dry-aged meat from McCann's, throw it on a grill, and put some asparagus next to it, and it tastes phenomenal. It's amazing. I can't necessarily just throw a piece of cauliflower on a grill and put it next to some asparagus and have it be equally as delicious. I don't think that's true. I love those things, but it's not equally delicious with as little effort. I think the options at our restaurants here are solid. After we talked recently, I did a survey of, I'd say, about 13 of the higher-end menus in town. I'm not going to name all the places for the sake of this. And it averaged about 3 dishes per menu, some as low as there's only a token salad, and some, I will name this place because Brian's on the phone and mentioned already, Owl House had over 10 options, wide ranging of whole different varieties.
Can I interject one thing briefly here, Chris? When you say you did sort of a survey of restaurant menus, of 13 menus, again, we know there are fully vegan restaurants in town. We know there are vegetarian restaurants. What we're talking about are restaurants that are not. And the question became, how much in recent years have they tweaked their menu to add vegan and vegetarian dishes based on what they think they need, based on what the demand is, et cetera. Okay, so out of these 13, what the average you said was, what, 2 or 3, or that was the most common?
Yeah, about 3. Yeah, about three. And I've been to all these places numerous times over the years. I'd say most of them had increased from what I'd seen before. Some of them have been doing this all along. I'll shout out a couple that have been doing it all along, like Avino's had dishes on their menu the whole time. They've got about 3 to 4. Places like the Owl House have wide-ranging options. Good Luck's a great example. You know, it's a place that, years ago you had modifiable things and vegetarian things, but over the last year have added 2 consistently vegan dishes on the menu other than their lentil dish. And that's a great thing, and I think more places are gaining at least a baseline of food that's not just the token dishes. Those drove me crazy when I was reviewing restaurants in city. The fact that, people were getting talked down to with this kind of food was enraging even then when I was still eating meat.
Well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by talked down to?
I think the fact if you just have a salad and a vegetarian pasta dish, you're not thinking about your clientele. I don't think you're providing a good option for people. And at this point, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't have a dish that's actually substantive.
Or multiple.
It requires some thought, some seasoning, some inspiration. Those aren't inspiring. You put something on there to basically tell them you have something, but you're not telling them you care about them. In having a dish on there that actually means something, that has some base, that has some interest, like, why not? Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of lack of effort and not caring about that part of your clientele.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I'm curious about Brian Van Etten's thoughts about that. Can you weigh in on that, Brian?
Yeah, I'll put on my business owner hat and just say that if you're not doing this as a business owner, it's your own loss. You know, the clientele is there, the clientele is hungry, and the clientele are coming and ordering. So, you know, you can throw a salad on there and then say, well, nobody orders it anyways. It's because it's a trash salad. You know, if you put some time and effort into these things and it pays dividends. And you know, I may not be serving fine dining at the places that I'm a part of right now, but I'm proof that the sales are increasing. People are more and more interested. The numbers are there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're not doing it, you know, yeah, it's your own loss, in my opinion.
When you sell,
and Brian knows I'm hungry and he can see my name on his order logs.
Well, and a number of emails already indicate that there is a very popular set of options that Brian does offer. So before I get John in Rochester on the phone, hang there. I just want to ask Brian to kind of describe, the menu at the Playhouse Swill Burger. I'd like you to describe, because I just looked at the menu for Pizza Wizard, and you have a FAQ where you say, do you have vegan options? And you write, we are currently offering Daiya cutting board cheese. If people like it, we'll keep it. The dough is all vegan. In addition, we have a salad that can easily be made without animal products. And oh yeah, a vegan meatball sandwich on homemade focaccia. So,
Swill Burger, I'll start with real quick.
Yeah.
You know, that we've been open for, five or six years. I don't even know, but, you know, we made it a point to have, you know, an option that tasted great, that wasn't a frozen veggie burger or whatnot. So we put on a burger that we spent a lot of time working on, that composed of beets, black beans, and brown rice with some other flavorings in there. It sold well from the get-go, and right off the bat, you know, the first few years, it was 10% of our sales, 12% of our sales, 15% of our sales. Right before, maybe a year before the pandemic, we introduced the Impossible Burger as well. And right off the bat, that thing flew. It just flew. People were hungry for it. I think it was, at the time, a novelty item. You couldn't find it anywhere, but it sold. And it sold to vegetarians and omnivores alike. And people would say, I like it better. I like it better than mm-hmm. meat. Year after year, within the last year, right when you called last night, I looked up just the last few months, and between the veggie burger and our Impossible Burger there, you know, the sales numbers, it's for every six burgers we sell, then we sell four of these. So it's what
I'm saying. Wow, that's more than I thought.
Options. It went from 10%, you know, to 20 to 30, and now it's up to 42%. So, the market is there. The market is there. In terms of options, you asked, and other items on the menu, you know, both places are a work in progress. When COVID hit, Swill had to limit a lot of our choices. We still do a pretty unique salad. We do tater tots. We put a bunch of fun toppings on them. They tend to be vegetarian and vegan. The pizza shop's a little bit of a different story. When we opened the pizza shop, the goal was every single item we have a vegan option for. I had zero experience in the pizza industry, with the exception of a six-month stint working at Papa John's when I was 15. So I vastly underestimated the amount of storage, cold storage I need for toppings. And with the volume we're doing right now, you know, I've got five or six toppings that I put on pizzas. Two of them are meat. The rest are vegetables. So it's not an extensive menu. That meatball sandwich on the FAQ page needs to come off, because that thing got tossed from the menu a few months ago.
You know? I'm sorry I got you in trouble there.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's a nice reminder of something I need to do. But the point is, the vegan community and vegetarian community and the curious eaters are out there and ordering these things. You know, I got a chef here today, Christian, who in the last 2 days provided me two different things that are fantastic. The one is like this homemade chorizo he made, which was vegan. He's done it with cauliflower, and he's done it with the Impossible Burger. The Impossible Burger chorizo, you cannot tell the difference if that's something you're looking for, mimicry of a pork chorizo. And he made a cheese today that he brought in. He put on a pizza. It's made with cashews. He gave me a bite. I ate it. I said, wow, this is absolutely fantastic. And how timely, based on this conversation, you know, it was a fantastic bite of pizza. It did have pepperoni on it, so I was a little biased, and that was a big part of the taste. But honestly, I didn't miss the dairy.
Yeah, the cashew cheese can be awesome.
It was fantastic. So we're ordering the products for next week to start playing with it. And why? You know, for multiple reasons. One, it's fun, and it's exciting, and it's something creative we can do that we like. But secondly, it sells. It sells, it sells, it sells. People want it. They're going to buy it. So why the hell am I not making it?
That is so interesting to me. I mean, it was maybe March 4th or 5th of 2020, and my soon-to-be 8-year-old at the time, he loves Playhouse. And it was like one of those days where I knew, looking at what was going on in the world, that this – I didn't even know if we should go out and play, like, video games and, like, get a burger in public because I knew things were about to blow up. But we went. That was the last place we went before things shut down. And we enjoyed the video games, and he got an Impossible Burger by choice. He wasn't even 8 years old. He loves burgers, and he loved it. And I'm like, why are you getting this, dude? And he's like, because it's good, and he loved it. So I just thought that was so interesting because a 7-year-old ain't choosing it unless he loves it, you know, and you got to really like it, and you got to get people to really feel like you're serious about something. It's not just an add-on or, as you say, a trash salad. So so that all of that is just so well said, and I think it paints such an interesting picture of where this industry is and who's serious and who's not. Let me grab a couple of phone calls. This is John in Rochester. Hi, John.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
I can. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, good. Yeah, I really agree with changing your source of foods as a means of experimentation. And I don't get to go to restaurants much. I mean, if I do, I just kind of like, fall off the wagon and go to Burger King, you know, or something like that. But I buy my own food. But yeah, I mean, I have a hard time amongst plants finding something that's real good with a good protein, right? But I found that with tofu and nuts. And, I mean, with a plant-based diet, you can get way too much saturated fat if you're not, careful. But with, like, say, coconut. But I'm fermenting a lot of my own food. I've foraged stuff in the wild.
Wow.
And it's really, I got exposed to some things that nobody else I know eats right now. I mean, like, there's a, right now out in the yard and fields, you'll find these, I think it's called buttercup. I thought it was a watercress, but it's got a little yellow flower. And the variety we got here that's, taken over almost as edible, even raw. And it's, I've been making wraps with it. But I find that stuff, I discovered a stinging nettle last year.
Oh, they're amazing.
By talking to some women, Bhutanese women, who were gathering it. And I saw, what's that? And I found out they're making chutney with it, right?
Oh, wow. And so, John, let me just jump in here. So you're mentioning some really interesting and cool stuff, and I heard Chris Lindstrom react. I think John said he's making ramps. So, Chris, usually when I figure out a trend is happening, it's because the trend is over. But is ramps having a moment, Chris Lindstrom?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're only 5 years behind or so.
See, that's what I mean.
no, but right now it's an amazing season for that. And he's mentioned a couple of fantastic products. But as you just mentioned, ramps are nearing the peak season right now. So if you go to the public market and you buy them from Alex Flowers in one of the open sheds, he forages on his own land. It's an amazing, really nice guy, does an amazing job. Also sells fiddlehead ferns, which are another spring foraged item that kind of have a cross between like an asparagus and a green bean. Amazing foraged thing, and it highlights spring at its best. But to the caller's point, yeah, there's so many opportunities to bring flavors, both with foraged goods and if you're willing to experiment with different seasonings. One of the things I've done to make things interesting is I shop at a whole variety of different stores, including obviously the public market, but like Spice Bazaar, an amazing Indian grocery in Henrietta, where I buy a lot of seasonings and chutneys. Mm-hmm. Asia Food Market, where you can buy your mushroom seasoning, miso, chili crisp, a whole wide selection of greens and rices and fermented greens. The International Food Market in Henrietta, where you can get, I've been buying cured chili flakes and some of the freshest sumac I've ever tasted. That's made my food even better. And it's just, you know, the experimentation and the variety of flavors is so wide and interesting if you're willing to experiment and try things out.
That's such cool stuff. And Brian Van Etten, I'm curious to know if you think there is anything else that maybe having a moment. I will only add to the whole notion of sort of a nut-based cheese or a cheese replacement that a friend of mine makes, stuffed shells. And I like it better when she takes the time to make it with, you know, not cheese, but with nuts. It takes a little more time. So sometimes she'll say, I'm making stuffed shells, and I want to warn you, I'm not doing it the way you want because she's busy with raising a kid. But I like it better that way. I'm curious to know if you think there's anything that's having a moment or that you're most excited about right now.
The thing to me that's just a standout, and this is pretty basic, but it's nut milks. Mm. You know, I can't think of the time when I last had, you know, a glass of milk, or milk with cereal or milk with anything. I just don't find it necessary. I don't find it tastes as good. And I just love, you know, I love the trends that are happening that are bringing a lot of these items to the forefront because, you know, it makes food more accessible for more people. It makes it a little more creative. A lot of times it can make it, you know, maybe push the needle a little bit on some environmental issues. And in my opinion, a lot of this stuff just tastes better.
Andrew writes, food culture has changed over time and will continue to do so. Can you imagine eating some of the stuff that was widely available as late as 20 years ago that today we wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole? I say to restaurateurs, continue to experiment and evolve. If you don't, your competitors certainly will, perhaps at your expense. That is exactly what Brian Van Etten is saying, with the attention to detail for vegan and vegetarian options, not just as a throw-on. And Heather says, just a huge thank you to Swillburger and a plea to keep your establishment safe as it currently is for those with celiac disease, regardless of any future dietary directions. Swillburger is one of about three restaurants in Rochester that understands gluten cross-contamination, so a shout-out there. Michael says, there are a number of restaurants in Rochester, Red Fern, Vula's, Owl House, The Playhouse, where you can get excellent vegan food. I mean food that is simply excellent, not just excellent for vegan. Brian makes one of the best vegan veggie burgers ever, and his BVE chickpea burger is excellent. That is from Michael. So really great feedback so far. And on the other side of this break, Catherine in Rochester, Deborah from Cuca Lake, we're going to take your phone calls. I know you've got great stuff to share here with our guests as we talk about, you know, not just sort of a trend. I don't think it's a trend. It's an evolution of restaurants taking vegan and vegetarian more seriously. I say that as someone who is not vegan. I think it's great, and I think it is probably overdue, and it's happening. Brian Van Etten is the owner of The Playhouse, Swillburger, and Pizza Wizard. Chris Lindstrom is the founder of Curate and the founder and host of Food About Town, who's been writing and blogging and podcasting about food in a wide range of platforms for years. Let's take that break and come back with your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. Has there been a leftward shift in politics at the state and national level? Are leaders like Joe Biden governing more like Barack Obama or Bernie Sanders? We'll explore it with local and statewide members of the Working Families Party who have been working on moving politics to the left. In our second hour, PEMDAS. What do you remember about math? And are you still using the math you learned in school? Talk with you Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, Catherine in Rochester. Next on the phone, go ahead.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment on my experience. I grew up in Rochester, in West Irondequoit, and I studied abroad in London for a semester. And I had just recently gone vegetarian, maybe like 3 years before that. And just like my experience there was incredible because I could walk into almost any restaurant and have a number of delicious options where it was like hard to choose what I wanted. I felt like the whole like culture there was different. Like it was just like way more accessible. Even in like grocery stores, like everything was very clearly labeled for vegetarians. And it definitely like, I don't know, proved to me that, it's definitely possible to make vegetarian food exciting and like a wide variety. You know, even just like random pubs would have vegetarian options. So.
And how do you sort of rate the Rochester scene right now as a whole?
I'd give it like a 4 or 5. I've been a vegetarian for about over a decade now. It's a lot of veggie burgers and pasta.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I definitely I love the Owl House and yeah.
Okay, so 4 or 5 now, but maybe a couple of points higher on that scale than it was 5, 10 years ago.
It's definitely gotten better for sure. It's definitely gotten better. I definitely still need to research a restaurant before I go to it. Whereas I felt like in the UK, I could just go into something blindfolded. I didn't have to know that it was, a certain kind of food or anything to know that there would be options for me.
That is such an important question. Thank you for the phone call. Such a great phone call. And that last point is one I really want to focus on here. So Chris Lindstrom, Catherine is making the point now that even with things getting better in Rochester, if you want to order vegan or vegetarian, or if you are vegan or vegetarian, if you're going out to eat, you still most of the time have to check the menu out in advance. Whereas in other cities where this is more established, you can just go out and you'll be well taken care of, that you'll find something you love. Do you find that to be the case, Chris?
I do. I think the base to that point is definitely correct. I still research places that I'm going to, and there are some places I don't go to anymore. Because they don't have any legitimate options. But what I'd like to do, at least for a couple minutes, is say, hey, there are an amazing variety of places. And I think when you look into the variety of places, when you're talking about specifically vegan, vegetarian from, and not away from maybe the places that everybody knows already, but places like, Allah's Kitchen, New Ethic Pizzeria, Natural Oasis, Vegan Ethiopian, places that were like not and now offer a lot of vegan options, like Sinelli's and Tree Town Cafe, and even Tapas in the city has a huge menu. But what I also would like to push is all of the cultural places that there's already a baseline of vegan and vegetarian dishes on the menus, like West Asian places, Lebanese and Syrian places like Cedar and Levantine's Cafe, Ethiopian food. East Asian food, like more traditional Chinese, or Sichuan, like Dragon Palace and Sichuan Opera, Thai food, Indian food, like Thali of India and Royal of India, which is kind of Nepalese, Jamaican places like Caribbean Heritage, Japanese food with ramen and sushi. I mean, there's so many options, but sometimes you do have to edge away from what I would call, I don't want to use the term generic American, but, places that are now considered, the Applebee's-esque menus that are standard or are one kind of thing. You have to sort of open your variety of places, and you'll find a huge variety of flavors that are worth exploring.
Well, Brian Van Etten, Mark says the next frontier is house parties. That's a hard one for vegans and vegetarians. And Ezra Klein mentioned that in his New York Times writing this week. He said that as a vegan, he often ends up just eating side dishes only. So I'm curious to know, Brian, if you think, we're kind of, I think that's sort of hand in glove or hand in hand with the notion of restaurants, assuming that there will be people who want vegan. And so that will be on the menu. I wonder if when people entertain at home, that will become more normal. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, sounds like you're SOL on that one. I got no advice for you on that one. That's tough. That's like going, I believe Ezra in their Twitter was talking about buffets and,
yep.
As simple as, the rest stop on the throughway, there's certain expectations you can have, and there's definitely some that you can't have right now. And, going to someone's house, you're definitely, at their will.
But if you entertain, are you asking guests in advance, Brian? I mean, I feel
me, yeah. Me, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Because I'm thoughtful towards diets. That's built into my system now, because owning a restaurant, if you're not thoughtful towards people's diets, you're losing money. So, when people come over, I'm always, and I can't remember the last time I had a party since COVID or a gathering, but you know, that's always something that should be a concern, especially anyone making food. You know, you take pride in making people happy. The whole point of bringing people over to make food is to make them happy, and part of it is to show off a little bit. You know, try some new dishes and techniques, and if you don't know what people are into, you know, or what their diets allow, then, you know, that just seems kind of lame.
All right, well, here's a pile of feedback from more listeners. Another listener says, I'm a lifelong vegetarian. I never feel the need to look at the menu beforehand. I think there's a fantastic selection of places for top-notch vegetarian eats in Rochester, and I've never been to a restaurant in Rochester without finding something to eat. David, writing to us from Vancouver, says, Evan and Megan, I'm reminded of when I first arrived at the University of British Columbia back in 1998. The department had a welcoming dinner for me at the faculty club, but when I looked at the menu, there was nothing vegan on it. The others ordered their fancy dishes. The chef came up with a plate of white beans for me. Needless to say, I never went to the faculty club again. These days, though, with the high rate of veganism in Vancouver, that does not happen. So, yeah, a lot's changed in 23 years, as an example there. And CT says, anyone who says vegan is bland has never been to Belgium in asparagus season. When working there years ago, the restaurants would serve 5 to 7 course meals, with each course with white or green asparagus. Fabulous flavors. And Fisher Hill Farm and the Rochester Public Hill Market and Brighton Market posted that asparagus season is beginning. Oh, yes. Asparagus is always early in the season. Oh, yeah. Always early in the season. I love white asparagus. I love CT's point there. That is a great one. And a listener named Mark wants to know if going vegan is going to save restaurants money. That's a very interesting question. Brian Van Etten, how do you sort of parse whether you're looking at 11 Madison Park or the establishments you've been at in Rochester? And is that likely to be different place to place, or is that likely to be more of a uniform answer? Obviously, it's not going to save you money if nobody comes and eats your food, but assuming that people do, how do you kind of figure out the money?
I guess it's place to place. You know, Swillburger, we proudly use Seven Bridges Farms for our beef, and we love the product. We think it's a well-raised and treated animal, and it comes to us fantastic. We love the flavor of it. It also isn't cheap. You know, if you're talking about some place that uses commodity beef for their burgers, and then they stopped using commodity beef and started, you know, coming up with a veggie burger recipe, then no, they won't save money. If I went fully vegetarian at Swillburger, we would probably save money on our food costs. You know, beef is probably one of our biggest overhead, our biggest food cost items. So you know, it may save some places money, but to me, that, you know, well, that could benefit the consumer ultimately, but it also could benefit the staff and the business strengths. So, you know, it's exciting more to me, less about the financial benefits and more about the idea. You know, you had somebody who you just mentioned that said, you know, that when they're at their supper club or their, you know, their staff club, they ask the chef to whip something up. I think a lot of chefs like that, you know, and embrace that thing too. You know, I know working in a kitchen and running a kitchen can be very tough and very stressful, but a lot of times when I'll speak from personal experience alone, when I've had somebody that had a special request or couldn't eat something or couldn't find something that was on the menu, it was one of the greatest joys was to whip something up for them with the limitations they had. Again, that kind of brings me back to the point that, you know, limiting yourself, whether it's completely or, you know, a percentage of how many proteins from animals you serve, it, to me, it only inspires and it only, you know, opens up your creativity, which is, you know, why this whole 11 Madison thing has got me thinking.
Sure. And maybe we'll start to go in our final few minutes in the direction of how this menu might come together. There's a lot of speculation about what 11 Madison does next, and I wanted to ask both of you about that. Brian, if you were working on the inside there and the decision is made to go vegan, first of all, tell me if I'm way off the mark here. My guess is they've got a lot of the menu already set. They know what they're going to roll out next month. They've got a plan to wow people, and it's not just pasta. But what do you think that process of creating these new dishes is like? And do you think that they're largely done? And you're never done in a restaurant, but you think a lot of that menu, that first menu, is done?
I would hesitate to think it's done. You know, the skill sets of their chefs and their, you know, sous chefs and line cooks and wait staff, they trump anything that I have ever been a part of or could ever be a part of. These are some of the most creative and skilled people in the American dining scene. So where they come up with this stuff, I haven't a clue. You know, like Chris, he's the type of person that sources things that, you know, I have never heard of or never knew existed, and maybe a little better resource to this. But when I see some of these dishes, whether it was at that restaurant Next, who was doing the vegan menu, 5-8 years ago, I don't understand a lot of this stuff. You know, I just don't know what it is. I see photos of it. It looks beautiful. I read reviews of it. It sounds amazing. But I just can't fathom it, you know. And to my understanding, a menu like this, you know, is under constant change and constantly modifying throughout day to day, even.
Well, if I was a better student of Connections history, I would remember that when you told me years ago on this program that the experience of opening night is something that, if you haven't worked it in a restaurant, it is something to behold. You'll always find someone who's crying.
Me.
It's often been you, and a lot of scrapped plans and lessons learned. So, right, I take the point that I'm sure, as much as they think that they've probably got things figured out for what they want to roll out for that first night next month, there's probably a lot that could change or maybe even blow up that day. There's always a curveball in restaurant business, isn't there? I mean, like an ingredient that's not available, something that doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah. Is that fair?
That's fair. But to the point that these people being prepared, I'm sure they're light years more prepared than I ever had been for a restaurant that I opened. Most of the time, it's just been fly by the seat of your pants and cross your fingers, hope for the best. But I'm sure they're prepared.
Chris Lindstrom, what do you think is most interesting about a restaurant like this turning this menu over entirely vegan? I mean, surely people are used to certain kinds of dishes, but where does your imagination go with what they might do?
Yeah, I think it opens up a world of possibilities. So let me list off how I would think about it personally.
Sure.
Is they have the resources to source from, you know, highly detailed farmers. You know, they can pay them higher wages to take a lot of attention to detail. They can grow exotic varieties or new varieties. They can force that to happen. So I imagine they're going to be hyper seasonal. They're going to really highlight the produce that they can within, you know, that 100-mile radius, and maybe take inspiration from somebody like Dan Barber, who's been involved with Row 7, and, you know, get more of those specifically grown pieces of produce that highlight sweetness and concentration of flavors. I would imagine they're taking inspiration from international cuisines, also with high-end techniques. I'm sure they have some of the best equipment in the world. So they can do, you know, compressions, they can do gels, they can do foams, they can do all that stuff. They have the manpower, they have the worker power to do that, to make that work. So I would expect, you know, delicate, refined techniques, amazingly sourced produce, and inspiration from a wide variety of backgrounds. And hopefully the staff is of a wide variety of backgrounds to get that, you know, to get those interesting flavors and maybe the flavors of home with refined techniques. That's what I would expect on a menu like that. And if I ever have the chance to go, that's what I would hope to see on that kind of menu.
Madhu writes to say, Evan, there is a whole country of 1 billion people called India who are primarily vegetarians. We have very delicious meals on a daily basis. Darn right. The food, the colors, the flavor, the sense of Indian cooking, absolutely phenomenal stuff. And I'm grateful for that email. And John says, Evan, please mention Nepalese Kitchen in Henrietta, mostly all vegan and awesome. Very good. So what we're finding out is there are a lot of options, more so than ever for vegans. And I just want to close maybe 30 seconds apiece here, Chris. This is a never-ending process, but how close is Rochester to the ideal that you want to see it?
We're not close, but that's okay. I think we have a lot of great options today. and a wide variety of them as well. So if we didn't mention somewhere that you love, or if you want more options, reach out to me directly at Stromey on Twitter and Instagram, and I will give you as many options as you can possibly handle. And I'll be thrilled to do it. This is part of my life now, and I want to highlight it as best I can.
Great stuff. And Brian Van Etten, for customers who worry that if they go to a Playhouse, Swillburger, a Pizza Wizard, what have you, and they want something that is vegan or vegetarian, that the chef will roll their eyes and make it work, what would you say to them?
I would say to them, you're spending money, and that's how my business operates, off of money. It pays our bills. So we do anything we can that we have access to make it work for you. You know, between the two businesses, the level of talent at these two businesses is absurd, especially for both of them, you know, seeming as a fast casual restaurant. The amount that we care and we try is, you know, right up there with any other restaurant, if not above, especially in terms of people's diets, vegetarian, veganism, and celiac.
I think it's a great message to close on. That's where this town is going. It's really where food and restaurant business is going. And Brian Van Etten, you can be humble. You can do that. But your friends and colleagues routinely have your name on the list of the most interesting and creative thinkers in food locally. And it's always interesting to see what you're doing with Playhouse, Swillburger, Pizza Wizard. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks so much, Evan. Appreciate it.
That's Brian Van Etten. Chris Lindstrom, the founder of Curate, who is probably, well, still growing that enterprise, I'm sure. How do people find you real quick, Chris? Curate.
CurateMeals.com, at Curate Meals on all your social medias. Reach out to us. We've got some great meals open for next week and 2 weeks after that.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Emma Ray Stein, Rob Braden, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.